Blog Talk Radio.
Why must we feel our futures so uncertain? Why must we feel our present is a burden?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Thank you for joining us this evening for our return. Wealth creation and preservation, alhamdulillah, mashallah. Let me state at the beginning here, we will not have the presence, the welcome presence of my dear co-host and brother, Malik Ali Sharif. We want to keep him in our dua. He is dealing with some significant challenges, and they're all around health. I need to just go ahead and say that so you won't read anything else into it. Allahu alam. We miss him dearly. We pray for him, and mashallah, he will return soon, inshallah. Today, well, it's all about Mr. Elon Musk and his impact on the crypto industry particularly, and we want to cut into that. I need to pull up my title for today because that is the thesis and the title that we've given to it is, What is Elon Musk's Impact on the Crypto Market? How and why? I have to tell you that in my just beginning the process of laying out some of the things that I considered addressing in this particular broadcast, I simply had to stop. It's just so much, alhamdulillah. And so I don't know if it's going to wind up being a series. I guess it has more to do with how long the impact that he seems to be the generator of remains. We'll see, but we're going to get into, you know, what can possibly be expected of that. And so I had actually like 10 pages of what I call mother sauce, and so I'm going to have to sort out which of those things we're going to focus on. I'm comfortable at this moment in preparing. The theme is going to be around aliens. We'll see. Maybe I can even say aliens and alienation, but we'll see what happens. As we normally do, we have an audio portion that we're going to play from the beginning, and there's going to be three. One is a short bio, comes off YouTube. It's put up by TechSpace, YouTuber. That's the title of their YouTube platform, TechSpace. And the title is The Insane Story Behind Elon Musk's Success. So that's like even if I want to call it a puff piece favoring Elon Musk, that's fine. That's what it is. What will follow after that is about a four-minute piece of an interview when Elon Musk was on the Joe Rogan Experience. And you get another feel for the nature of his temperament in that sense. And then finally, we're going to conclude the audio portion that introduces the balance of the broadcast with Michael Saylor on the Jamie Tree YouTube segment. And its title is Michael Saylor Responds to Elon Musk, Bitcoin Environmental Impact and Energy Debate. We'll end that and then I'll come back and we'll get into this Mr. Elon Musk and his impact on cryptocurrency, the how and the why. Alhamdulillah, so enjoy. We start off first with this piece regarding the insane story behind Elon Musk's success. Thank you for being here. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Elon Musk is one of the richest and most successful men on the planet, with his immense intelligence being the key to how he's accomplished so much. But how did he get so smart? Let's explore that question. To understand how Musk is so smart, now we need to go all the way back to the beginning and see the metaphorical seed Musk was turned into. Elon Musk was born on June 28, 1971 in South Africa. As a child, he would get so lost in his daydreams and thoughts, his parents had his hearing checked due to his not listening to adults very often. Musk's parents got divorced when he was 10, and around that time, he developed an interest in computers. At only age 12, Musk created a video game called Blastar. He was able to sell at a profit to a magazine that then published the source code and paid him $500. In 1984 money, that was a lot. Due to being short and bookish, Musk would at times be picked on in school. At age 15, he had a sudden growth spurt, however, and began learning karate. Elon Musk is one of the richest and most successful men on the planet, with his immense intelligence being the key to how he's accomplished so much. But how did he get so smart? Let's explore that question. To understand how Musk is so smart, now we need to go all the way back to the beginning and see the metaphorical seed Musk was turned into. Elon Musk was born on June 28, 1971 in South Africa. As a child, he would get so lost in his daydreams and thoughts, his parents had his hearing checked due to his not listening to adults very often. Musk's parents got divorced when he was 10. And around that time, he developed an interest in computers. At only age 12, Musk created a video game called Blastar. He was able to sell at a profit to a magazine that then published the source code and paid him $500. In 1984 money, that was a lot. Due to being short and bookish, Musk would at times be picked on in school. At age 15, he had a sudden growth spurt, however, and began learning karate as well as wrestling to defend himself. From this young age, it was apparent that when Musk put his mind to something, he worked incredibly hard at it. Whether this was programming with such skill he made an actual video game at age 12, or learning a wide range of martial arts such as Kyokushin Karate, Taekwondo, Judo, and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. This dedication to learning continued as Musk entered his collegiate years. Musk moved to Canada at age 17 in the year 1989 to attend Queen's University. One reason he left South Africa for his collegiate education was to avoid the mandatory period of service in South Africa's military, residents otherwise faced.
Growing up in apartheid South Africa was pretty surreal. I mean, we didn't support that government, we didn't believe in it. And so the idea of actually going to the military service was really out of the question.
Musk was able to obtain Canadian citizenship after moving there, theorizing it would be easier to eventually obtain American citizenship as a Canadian in future years. In 1992, Musk was accepted to the University of Pennsylvania and moved there to obtain an undergraduate degree in economics and then another bachelor's degree in physics. Musk was accepted to the prestigious Ivy League University of Stanford in California and moved there with a plan to study energy physics. However, the internet boom was starting, so after just 2 days as a student at Stanford, he dropped out. He created his company, Zip2 Corporation, with assistance from his brother, Kimball. It was 1995, and Musk had officially entered the world of business. Before long, things would never be the same. The Zip2 Corporation helped provide online city guide software to newspapers that were trying to break into the then newer internet. Their office was tiny, and Musk would sleep in the little room most nights as he did almost nothing but work his hardest to make the software among the best possible.
When my brother and I were starting our first company, instead of getting an apartment, we just rented a small office and we slept on the couch. And we showered at the YMCA, and we're so hot up we had just one computer, so the website was up during the day and I was coding at night. 7 days a week, all the time. And I briefly had a girlfriend in that period, and in order to be with me, she had to sleep in the office.
Zip2 and its online city guides were a hit. It was so successful that in 1999, a division of Compaq Computer Corporation bought Zip2 for $307 million in cash and $34 million in stock options. Musk had gone from a broke and nerdy programmer to a multi-millionaire. He could have stopped there, but his thirst for knowledge and success meant he was only just starting on his road to achievements. Keep in mind that Musk studied economics and physics in college. He didn't study programming or the field that he went into next, online financial services. Musk just was so incredibly curious about the world, he would constantly read books and want to learn new things. This desire to learn helped Musk to be able to basically see what the next big thing would be. And Musk foresaw that as the internet grew to be able to pay for things online, it would need to be streamlined and become easier. Musk found X.com. With this, and eventually it merged with a company known as PayPal. Yes, that PayPal. It was 1999 when Musk joined PayPal, and in 2002, it was bought out by eBay for $1.5 billion. Musk owned 11.5% of PayPal's stock when it was bought out by eBay. Musk had been working mostly in the field of programming at this time, but he wasn't done expanding his learning or businesses. In 2002, Musk founded SpaceX with the goal of using his physics knowledge and business sense to create a company that could explore outer space and eventually take humans to Mars. It seemed far-fetched back then, as space wasn't privatized. It was something governments explored. SpaceX kept developing amazing technology, however, and now in 2021, it is the company NASA uses to launch spaceships ever since NASA stopped making its own. It also is launching thousands of satellites into space for a program known as Starlink, which will provide speedy broadband internet to the entire world. If Musk was solely doing SpaceX, this would all be incredible. But he is also the CEO of Tesla, a company he joined shortly after its founding in 2003, and which is the leader in making cutting-edge yet affordable electric cars. Tesla has become a household name over the years and is only expanding as a company as it introduces an electric pickup truck known as the Cybertruck and possibly has plans for an electric SUV. Musk has accomplished so much. He must be a genius, right? Well, that's only part of it. While measuring someone's IQ is an extremely inefficient way to actually determine intelligence, it can help give a general idea of someone's innate ability to learn. There are people with amazing IQs who actually may be considered lacking in intelligence, and others who have an average IQ but work hard and accomplish a lot. Musk is thought to have an IQ of around 155, with an average being 100, and only around 1% of the world's population having an IQ above 140. Between his amazing work ethic that has been discussed and his IQ that is much above normal, a picture becomes apparent of Musk being someone with both natural gifts and an amazing dedication to working hard. Musk could have simply been someone who was born with the ability to learn, but didn't put any effort forth in life, or been someone who lacked natural gifts, but still worked very hard for success. Because of his thirst for knowledge and amazing work ethic, Musk was able to achieve so much. It goes to show that even if you don't have an amazingly high IQ, that is only part of the success of someone like Musk. After all, you don't see videos of him bragging about being smart. You see videos of him bragging about working hard. Musk talks about how he is always trying to learn, still works so much at his factories that he at times sleeps in them.
Like it cold?
I sleep on the couch over there.
So you're just laying here
yeah.
on the couch?
Yeah. Last time I was here, I actually slept literally on the floor because the couch was too narrow.
Yeah, I was going to say. And Elon, I have to say, it's not even a comfortable couch either.
No, it's terrible. This is not a good couch.
Once Musk realizes one achievement he desires, he makes another. It would have seemed crazy in 1995 to make $1 billion with a web payment processor. Then it would have seemed impossible to create a mass market electric car. It also would have sounded insane to privatize space travel. Musk didn't let anything stop him, however. He sets out to learn as much as he can about something that interests him and proceeds to master it. Whether it's programming, martial arts, electric cars, space travel, or anything else.
Two, one, boom. Thank you. Thanks for doing this, man. Really appreciate it.
Hey, welcome.
It's very good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And thanks for not lighting this
welcome
place on fire.
You're welcome.
That's
coming later.
How does you create cars, rockets, all this stuff you're doing, constantly innovating, decide to just make a flamethrower? Where do you have the time for that?
Well, the flame, we didn't put a lot of time into the flamethrower. This was an off-the-cuff thing. And so I have sort of like, it's sort of a hobby company called The Boring Company, which started out as a joke, and we decided to make it real, and dig a tunnel under LA, and then other people asked us to dig tunnels, and so we said yes in a few cases. and then we have a merchandise section that only has one piece of merchandise at a time. And we started off with a cap, and there was only one thing on. It was just boringcompany.com/cap or hat. That's it. And then we sold the hats, limited edition. It just said The Boring Company. And then I'm a big fan of Spaceballs, the movie. And in Spaceballs, yogurt goes through the merchandising section, and they have a flamethrower in the merchandising section of Spaceballs, and the kids love that one. That's the line when he pulls out the flamethrower. It's like, we should do a flamethrower. So we.
Does anybody tell you no? Does anybody go, Elon? Maybe for yourself, but selling a flamethrower, the liabilities, all the people you're selling this device to, what kind of unhinged people are going to be buying a flamethrower in the first place? Do we really want to connect ourselves to all these potential arsonists?
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. Terrible. Shouldn't buy one. I said don't buy this flamethrower. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. That's what I said. But still, people bought it.
Yeah,
there's nothing I can do to stop them.
If you build it, they will come.
I said, don't buy it. It's a bad idea.
How many did you make?
It's dangerous. It's wrong. Don't buy it. And still, people bought it. I just couldn't stop them.
How many did you make?
20,000.
And they're all gone.
I think 4 days. But it sold out in 4 days.
Are you going to do another run?
No.
No, that's it.
Yes.
Oh.
I said we would do 20. We did 50,000 hats. That was $1 million. And he's like, okay, we'll sell something for 10 million, and that was 20,000 flamethrowers at $500 each. They went fast.
How do you have the time to do that, though? I mean, I understand that it's not a big deal in terms of all the other things that you do, but how do you have time to do anything? I don't understand your time management skills.
I mean, I didn't spend much time on this flamethrower. I mean, to be totally frank, it's actually just a roofing torch with an air rifle cover. It's not a real flamethrower.
Which is why it says not a flamethrower.
That's why we were very clear. This is not actually a flamethrower. And also we were told that various countries would ban shipping of it, but they would ban flamethrowers. So to solve this problem for all the customs agencies, we labeled it not a flamethrower.
Did that it way, work? Is it effective?
I don't know. I think so. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I think there's something cruel and tasteless about an entitled rich white male that wants to deprive billions of poor women and children and men in Africa, Asia, and South America of the basic human right of economic self-preservation so he can generate some laughs.
On the whole topic of energy, he did also go off on how environmentally unfriendly Bitcoin is, was raging on about the massive carbon footprint. I mean, the stats differ. Some say Bitcoin has a carbon footprint comparable to that of New Zealand, that it consumes more electricity than the entire annual energy consumption of the Netherlands. I mean, various different stats from various different sources. According to the Cambridge Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index, Bitcoin mining operations worldwide now use energy at the rate of the same annual domestic electric consumption of the entire nation of Sweden. Michael, different stats. but they emphasize the fact that there's huge energy consumption here. In this era of sustainability and ESG and Green New Deals, do you see that as a potential issue?
In this video, Michael Saylor responds to Elon Musk tweeting out regarding environmental concerns surrounding Bitcoin, which in turn caused not just the Bitcoin price to drop, but the entire cryptocurrency market. For those that missed it, Elon Musk tweeted out that Tesla would be halting any payments for cars via Bitcoin, and Michael Saylor, a few hours later, responded by showing another large purchase of Bitcoin through MicroStrategy. In this interview on Kitco News, Saylor speaks on the truth regarding Bitcoin and energy consumption and its environmental impacts. Make sure to stick around to the end of the video where we cover some on-chain Bitcoin data that will be of comfort for all cryptocurrency holders. Also, only a tiny percentage of my viewers are actually subscribed. If you enjoy crypto content, consider subscribing. It's free and you can always change your mind. Enjoy the video.
And so I think the entire Bitcoin community, they just find it to be tasteless, what he's done, and elitist. With regard to the energy, again, he's a comedian. He hasn't spent 100 hours studying it. The world generates 160,000 terawatt hours of energy a year. Of that, 50,000 terawatt hours of energy is wasted, like 30%. Of that, 120 terawatt hours is used to run the entire Bitcoin network. To put that in perspective, that's 7.5 basis points of all the energy in the world. The truth of the matter is everything on Earth uses more power than a small country. Bill Maher uses 10 times, or electricity that costs 10 times as much as the electricity used in the Bitcoin network to enrich himself. And he's not really thinking about it. If you take all the energy used in the Bitcoin network, it amounts to 25 basis points of all the wasted energy. So 0.25% of the wasted energy in the world offers the hope of a decent life to 8 billion people and solves an economic problem. But the 25 basis points is of the wasted energy, because the Bitcoin network is the bidder of last resort for all energy. So if you eliminated Bitcoin from the world and you robbed the billions of people of a decent chance at a decent life, then you wouldn't stop any waste. You're still going to waste 50,000 terawatt hours of energy. So he's focused upon a nothing. If you actually study the Bitcoin network, you'll find that there's about $1 trillion of assets under management. It's secured by about $2 billion worth of energy a year. Call it 20 basis points. 20 basis points of the energy in the network is the cost to secure it. Now, that energy probably costs about 2 cents a kilowatt hour. That's what's being paid for it, maybe. And in many cases, it is literally discarded energy, and there is zero value for it. No one would pay anything for it. So its marginal value to the human race is literally zero. Whereas the marginal cost of consumer energy and industrial energy is 11 to 13 cents a kilowatt hour. When people are watching Bill Maher on their iPads and their iPhones, they're paying at least 13 cents a kilowatt hour. Plus they pumped it into their lithium ion batteries on their devices, which probably jacked up the cost by a factor of 10. He's got no problem with them watching, getting laughs, right? Wealthy people getting laughs on expensive energy. Meanwhile, people that are destitute in the rest of the world have a chance at a decent life using marginal cast-off energy, and anybody would deny them that. But I can only say, giving him the benefit of a doubt, he's a comedian. And he's playing this for laughs, and his job is to act like a fool. And if you take economic, political, or technical advice from a fool, what does that make you?
There is this narrative that it's an environmental threat. Is that something that you see derailing the rise of Bitcoin in any way, shape, or form?
I don't think so. Because, I mean, as I pointed out, right, there are 50,000 terawatt hours of wasted energy, and this is literally 25 basis points of that. It's a nothing. If you're concerned about the environment, you're going to focus in on the dirty energy sources, and there's 100x or 1,000x bigger target in a lot of other areas. If you look at the energy consumption of the Bitcoin network, one of the characteristics of the proof-of-work network is that you only mine Bitcoin in a jurisdiction where the energy is cast off, stranded, or recycled, therefore marginally not valuable, and you also only mine it in a place where you're politically welcome. So no one's going to set up a coal power plant in the middle of Central Park, Manhattan, and mine Bitcoin because it wouldn't be politically welcome. In fact, in any country where they were to decide that the Bitcoin miners are not welcome because they use energy, the miners are just going to move to a different country. And one of the powerful characteristics of the Bitcoin network is the fact that it is constantly decentralizing to the most politically supportive jurisdiction. It's also decentralizing to the place where energy is the least expensive, probably the cleanest renewable energy, but certainly the least expensive energy anywhere in the world. And the other thing that happens is, the miners are constantly securing the network because they're upgrading the technology all the time. And the miners are, because they're capital intensive, they're raising capital from financiers in each of these political jurisdictions all the time. And the combination of those things means that wherever mining's not welcome, it's going to move. And wherever it moves to, it's going to be by definition welcome. And it's going to be very harmonious with the energy grid. So I don't really think that the energy usage of Bitcoin represents a threat. I actually think the opposite, which is the energy usage of a proof-of-work crypto asset network creates 7 layers of security to the asset, which are absolutely critical. The first layer of security is they co-opt all of the energy producers worldwide to support the network, because you can sell energy at about 45 to 50 cents a kilowatt hour to the network. It's the highest value use of energy in the world, and anybody can plug into it. So that's very powerful. The second is it co-opts the technology producers. People are producing these SHA-256 ASICs, like the S19 miners, and that means all of the technology companies are continually building better equipment that's more energy efficient. The third is it co-opts politicians like the governor of Texas. There's no way the governor of Texas would be supporting Bitcoin except for the fact that Bitcoin mines in Texas are creating jobs and bringing tax revenues to Texas, and they're providing massive revenues to Texas energy producers. The fourth is it co-opts Wall Street, because Wall Street's financing all of these Bitcoin miners in a big way. And you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of multi-billion dollar entities that are financing them. The fifth is it makes the security temporal. It takes 24 to 48 months to actually create a material Bitcoin mining operation. So if you wanted to attack the network, you've got to do it over the course of 36 months without 250 million people figuring out that you're going to do it. And then it also decentralizes it spatially, because you can't locate all of the Bitcoin mining in the world in one spot, because you can't get enough energy in the one spot. And so you've got a natural spatial decentralization. After you finish with those 6 things, the 7th layer of security is the mining network. You end up with hundreds of miners that have invested billions, if not tens of billions of dollars in creating these security data centers or security nodes, which we call Bitcoin mines. And they've got so much vested interest in running the network. They've all got the support of their local politicians, their local governments. They're going to defend the network. And there are 2 more dynamics very important. One, if I had $1 billion of gold in Manhattan, you'd be relying upon the mayor of New York City and the governor of New York and the country of the United States to secure your gold. But if you have $1 billion of Bitcoin in Manhattan, the security comes from a decentralized set of nodes in other jurisdictions, not even in the U.S. And even if the U.S., the mayor, and the governor attack your money, you end up with someone in Iceland or Finland or China or Iran or Iraq or someplace in the in some cyberspace you can't even find that's defending your money. And so that's a very, very powerful idea. The last point I'll make is that 20 basis points of energy used to mine to actually secure the network, that's exponentially decreasing. What's going on right now is the revenue and the block rewards in the Bitcoin network are falling every 4 years. So by the year 2035, 99% of the Bitcoin's been mined, and that means that the network starts to run only on transaction fees. The incentive of the network to burn energy will fall almost by an order of magnitude, and the efficiency of the SHA-256 ASICs will increase by an order of magnitude. So what you've got is a network that's decentralizing itself and making itself exponentially more efficient. So you could reasonably expect, if we look 20 years out, that probably the cost to secure $100 trillion, well, it might be $50 billion, but that would be five basis points of the total value on the network, which makes it the least energy intensive, most efficient technology that we have perhaps discovered ever in the history of the human race.
So there's Michael Saylor clearing up the FUD surrounding Bitcoin and its total energy consumption. It seems odd Tesla and Elon Musk decided to buy into BTC and accept Bitcoin payments without doing the research and due diligence behind it. Is there something more going on behind the scenes? Now, for some on-chain Bitcoin data that may be of comfort to holders, immediately after Elon Musk's tweets, we saw a huge spike in Bitcoin being sent onto exchanges, a three-year high as investors scrambled to sell the cryptocurrency. Scary stuff. However, I am happy to report that since then, out from Willy Woo via Glassnode, Bitcoin has again turned to flowing out of exchanges as highlighted in green. Some big buyers and whales buying the dip. Anyway guys, let me know in the comments what you think of this whole fiasco and what your thoughts on Elon Musk are now. Hope that provided you with some value, I'll see you in the next video, and as always, have a great day.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, wa Bismillah, Rahman, Rahim. A little bit of a blast from the past. I can't imagine when was the last time any of you actually heard that Temptation live. Forgive me for the overdrive in the sound. However, I do have an appointment coming up with my sound technician support, so it's all good. You know, got to live on, man. You got to live on. Deal with life such as it is. So I figured I'd bring Paul Bitcoin Williams. Come on and let you know what you ought to do. So if it's lost that you're running from, there's no hiding place. You're going to lose something. Because you got to keep on walking. Don't look back. Keep on walking. Don't look. That's what we're going to do. That's what we're doing. Alhamdulillah. MashaAllah. It's so, such a blessing that's in store for you if you understand it. If you understand it. All right. So welcome again. Now, what I want to do today, if you heard the introduction to the piece that we went through, I tell you, I just have pages. This is no post. It's just what it is. Pages of material, different angles that this Elon Musk episode can be approached from. And I'm speaking especially those of you who, I mean, if you've been hanging out around the pool or what have you, and you haven't quite stuck your toe in, and you're thinking about it, oh, I'm glad I didn't, because you may be one of those. You may be one of those who made the commitment and then bang, then it drops right after that, whatever. You may be someone who's holding this, just trying to work out, trying to figure out, trying to get some clarity on what's happening. You should be, and again, I'm saying there's so many angles. So this is what I would like to have from you today. What is it that you want to know? It's not to say that I have every answer or anything like that, but more than likely, we've all asked ourselves some of the same questions around this particular time issue and matter. So I'm saying, what is your question? What's your concern? What you want to be cleared up on? What have you come to know? Et cetera. Come on. You need to come on and ask. So, you know, I can make some selections about things that I'm going to, and I will ultimately. But I would prefer to be responding to, well, what is it that you want to know? What is it that you understand? What are you doing because of it? And the like. So there's so many different angles for it. So let me stop my little piece right now, and y'all punch up and ask me a question or something. How do I feel about this, and what do I think about that, and what am I doing because of this, because of that? Come on, because that's the kind of pressure. You know, the angel Jibril came to the prophet, peace be upon him, and we have that hadith of Jibril. He came down, mashallah, particularly, according to the history of the report, he came down because the prophet wanted people to ask questions, but people weren't asking questions, because the questions is where you learn about whatever the subject matter is. You got to have some questions. If you don't have the questions, you don't have anything to go after. The right question is half of knowledge, right? So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent the angel Jibril to ask the questions, and now we have that. And I know for personally, directly from the imam, that was how he taught. That was how he taught. What's your question? I'm talking about when you talk to me, he and me. What's your questions? Boom. So come on through. We got a, this looks like it's like a Philly number. I don't know. Is it a Philly number? 215. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Brother Dante, Eva Bada, Assalamu alaikum, brother Iman.
Hey, Dante, come on, man. Tell us what's good, bro. Tell us what's good.
Well, as I missed the last broadcast, but I listened to it, and I think that I'm at the PhD level, six figures, following your guidance. And the
Allahu
Akbar. Bitcoin.
So you rocking six figures behind that Bitcoin now?
Rocking. Yes,
they don't know,
yes,
man.
Sir.
They don't know. I keep trying to tell them they don't know. So we got our PhD declared. We got our first declared PhD. Alhamdulillah.
Absolutely. And my wife is 100% on board. She is actually more involved than I am. She's become...
Yeah.
like a you know, with the other cryptos and purchasing, researching and purchasing the other cryptos, Cardano, Compound, yeah, all of those different things that we talk about. She is all over it and doing very well. But the question I do have is, we were debating, does it make sense? And for me, my answer is no, but so that I can go back to my wife and get confirmation, or, you know, give her your perspective. Is it wise to sell like a portion of the Bitcoin that you have now at the value that you have it, and then come back and buy the dip?
No, that's my opinion. The rock figures. Go ahead. I didn't let you finish. Go ahead.
No, I mean I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just wanted a different perspective, if it makes sense, because Michael Saylor is, you know, and some of the other guys, I'm not selling one Satoshi, and that has kind of been my stance. But we were debating that, and I just wanted to get your perspective on that.
Well, that is the perspective, and myself, my co-host, he has Malik, you know, he calls it Sinkersville. He said when you get that Bitcoin, it's going to Sinkersville. It ain't coming out. And Michael Saylor said, it's like it's the kind of asset that you buy, you know, automatically minimum 4 years in mind, but his is, you know, thinking in terms of a century, and again, further than that, you know, or rather further than that, inside or between the two, it's like 10 years, like minimum. You don't think about it as far as that is concerned. Now, so that's the answer for as far as that's concerned. So what I want to mention, however, which you likely know, but I'll say it anyway, and that is the way that you deal with it is you, quote unquote, it just in general, you sell high and buy low. That more particularly relates to what's called altcoins, but there's supposed to be another more complementary name for altcoins. Now I'm not thinking of it right away. So the point is, investing in those other assets, let's just call them, investing in those other assets, otherwise known as altcoins, that's where you quote unquote generate the money from. And plus, the upside for them is actually much bigger in terms of room to move and room to grow. So then it becomes the most important thing is the due diligence that you put into the decision that you make to own that other asset, and then again, you can move your money around, move the assets around, or move your investments around inside that portfolio. But I believe that because of the nature of Bitcoin, then when you do take profits from some of those other alts, the idea is to convert that profit into Bitcoin. So it's like you're Bitcoin, using the profits from those other movers to generate the wherewithal to buy more Bitcoin. And since I think you do know about the DeFi space and your ability to actually leverage as collateral the Bitcoin that you own to get fiat to do other things that you want to do without losing or risking your Bitcoin. So it's Bitcoin. Like it's really a win-win situation.
Yep, understood.
Does that get to it?
Yeah, it's finished. It's done. So I know what to tell my wife then. just as a final note, my 19-year-old son, he took $2,000 of the money that he saved and purchased Bitcoin. And my daughter, my 23-year-old daughter, is also purchasing Bitcoin. Like they really taken to the advice and they purchased it. I'm just so thankful that coming into what you have brought to us and me being able to share with them and them seeing the vision that I've been blessed to see, and they're taking it as well. So,
that's wonderful. That is wonderful. And the best is yet to come. Alhamdulillah. Yes. So keep us up to date. And let me say while I got you here, which is what you know, that when you build a portfolio of those other assets, when you build a portfolio and you're working with quote unquote six figures, then that means on a weekly basis, most definitely on a monthly basis, you can generate five figures just from the six figure portfolio. You got a six figure portfolio, mm-hmm. You can generate five figures in a week and definitely in a month, right? So mm-hmm. If you got five, you can generate four figures. It just goes like that, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, yeah. Yeah, the best is yet to come. This right now, this is a quote unquote. This is a downside, but this is also like what they say in the mercantile period. Like this is like Black Friday, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, there's sales everywhere. I mean,
that's what that guy. They said the guy Willie Noon or Willie Lou said that the whales.
Yeah, Willie Lou.
And said the whales are buying the dip. So
that's what they're doing.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So are you going to touch on the significance of where he talked about, where Michael Saylor talked about seven layers of security and the symbolic number of seven and how important
part
that
of
is?
I pulled out part of it. And since you came forward and shared as much as you shared, I'll make that the starting point of comments that I will make. Yes, I pulled out. I didn't scale out every one of those seven, but the seven that he talked about. But let me tell you, you can go and hear the whole thing. You go to YouTube and just search under Michael Saylor under Michael Saylor energy consumption, and you should be able to find it there. Let me be more accurate.
Because I heard so the portion that you played, I heard that earlier today. But I haven't heard the whole thing. So some of it was above my head. So
yeah. So just look under Michael Saylor responds to Elon Musk, Bitcoin environmental impact and energy debate. You'll find it. And he's been interviewed by this this whatever. I guess it's kind of a dirty blonde head. I don't want to be mean, but hey. Either way. So look that up. See, he's side by side with this woman interviewing him. And that's where that is. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. So That's wonderful. So we're looking at some of the future wealthiest people in our community. We're hearing from about right now. You're witnessing the birth of stars. Allahu Akbar. Any other comments, questions, et cetera? I am going to go to what Dante just talked about. Go ahead and use that as a starting point. But anybody else? Feedback, questions, comments. What is it you want to know, need to know? What is it you don't understand, et cetera, about what's going on here? All right. So I'm going to go on then. I'll just go on. And whatever we get led to, then that's where we'll go. So the big issue, the issue is, Elon Musk, He applauds Bitcoin and says we'll take Bitcoin for Tesla automobiles, et cetera. He bought $1.5 billion in Bitcoin, and everybody is excited about him getting on board. You know, it's like game over now. We're ready to go, blah, blah. Okay, and then he turns around and, you know, drops this lug. The carbon footprint or whatever, the energy consumption and all that, that side of that criticism was brought up. And so Michael Saylor, of course, you know, he who was the let's call it the corporate crypto evangelist, Bitcoin evangelist, more or less, inviting and showing all the corporate leaders who are interested how and why they should actually get involved with Bitcoin. So I don't know why my Facebook, as we say in Ebonics, Facebook is cooking. Okay. So let me start over here. It is what it is. All right. So in terms of that, let's walk through that. So Michael Saylor, this is why when I opened up and talked about it, so here you actually have like two rocket scientists competing with each other. Michael Saylor, Elon Musk, he's actually, quote unquote, doing the whole and that whole piece, and then Michael Saylor's MIT and his training was to become an astronaut, and he had all the learning, but for some health scenario that turned out to be a quote-unquote false positive situation for him, he never got to be that astronaut that he was doing. But that level of knowledge, that level of intellect that's involved, so this is like two titans. And somewhere down the line, we may get to it. We'll be talking about black magic and white magic, if not today. But the issue of the energy consumption, let me tell you from a debate perspective, it is a red herring. It's a red herring. It's just something being dragged into the issue that is really. There's no legs for it. There's no legs for that argument, but that's not the important thing, because what you actually see Elon Musk doing in this particular instance is the same thing that the former president Donald Trump did. It's a Twitter thing. It's a tweet thing. It's manipulating the power of your whatever Twitterverse, your Twitter network, your Twitter following, in order to move the sentiments, emotions, et cetera, of the people that are in your network. But let's share the counterpoint. Let's share the counterpoint. It's like when you have the atmosphere, you have the whole Black Lives Matter thing, for example, and how much the corporate community and other aspects of society have been bent, molded, shaped, influenced by the surge of sentiment around that thesis, right? So it's like even if you're not aligned with it as a real philosophical or political or social or personal position, from a corporate citizen point of view, it's like, man, you need to demonstrate either just be real quiet or demonstrate that you're with it or keep your head down, et cetera. So the influence is there. Okay, similarly, as relates to environmental concerns, there's a very large network, a very large, you know, global, you know, what's that, the little young girl, whoever, I can't think of her name, Greta somebody. Either way, that whole kind of thing, that's the hypersensitivity around the issue of environment. So that means that there's a large pool of sentiment, sensitivity, large pool of advocacy, large pool of believers in environmental sustainability, green-minded, et cetera, that's out there. And if you can conjure that and you, or, quote-unquote, tap into it, speaking of it as an energy source, you can tap into it and then move it in the direction that you want to move it in, then you have, again, accessed some people power, some social power, some network power in terms of your interest. So, okay, so that's out there. And so this statement, so to tap into that sensitivity and to conjure in that sensitivity is what Elon Musk actually did. Now, I'm not going to the details right now because that is the part of it when I say what I'm saying right now, renewable energy credits, all right? When you talk about all the president's men, I believe that's what it was, the whole Watergate thing, and then Deep Throat said, follow the money. I said, follow the money. Okay, well, that's the simple, crass, direct thing where there were so many people. I was listening to one of the YouTubers that's usually very, very calm, stable, very even, level-headed. Like, he was just totally miffed by, I don't understand it. Well, it doesn't make any sense to me. Why would you spend $1.5 billion and then come out this way about that and then just doing that? It's like, yeah, what? I don't understand it. I don't understand that. I mean, he was online. So there was this piece, or there is this piece where people, you know, quote unquote, don't get it. But a day or two later, you know, it came out that the real profit side of Tesla is not the sale of cars. It's not the sale of cars. They reported my summation of one report that I'm thinking about is the last quarter's profit or something was some $500 million. When all was said and done, $500 million was the bottom line profit for Tesla, but it wasn't from selling cars. The profit, that profit of half a billion dollars were equated with the $500 million that they earned from selling renewable energy credits to other industrial operations that have a bigger carbon footprint, right? You talk about dirty energy, those kind of things. So there's some kind of way that inside that game, that if you buy renewable energy credits. I haven't studied that per se, and you can go do that. But that's the explanation where the money side of it. How is it profitable for Tesla to do what they did in that regard? Well, it has to do with something that's coming up as relates to I don't know if it's an ETF or something else that's coming up in a few days, weeks, or et cetera. Around being able to make more profit from those renewable energy credits, and so it's like a setup to position himself, Tesla, et cetera, in order to enter into that market, which is something that is new. So when from the follow the money piece, that's it. And so in terms of generating. Attention, interest, and those kinds of things. That's one side of it. But so as Michael Saylor said, which I'm going to mention right now, it's like that is a non-issue. That's a nothing. But it's enough to smear, and obviously it's enough to depress, if not momentarily, the quote unquote the Bitcoin market. But one of the articles I read this morning, or that I came across headlines mainly, that's all you need really, is that he tweeted, Elon Musk, he tweeted out that, let me make it clear, we have not sold any Bitcoin. we have not sold any Bitcoin, all right? So then what are you saying? I'm not trying to answer that for him. The point is he already knows, but I'm still not selling my Bitcoin. Yeah, why? How come you don't sell? If it's so bad for the environment, you need to sell it, right? No, because that's the other part of the game. You know, crazy like a fox, right? So that's not it. So in terms of that, compare that to. What was that recently? I think the Golden Globes. The Golden Globes got canceled because there were no, I think I got the right organization, because there were no blacks on the board in the Academy of Golden Globes that were doing the voting on all these movies, et cetera. And Tom Cruise, I'm basically operating from rumor right now because I never read anything about it, but I believe it was him. Tom Cruise, he gave his Golden Globes back to the organization, and everything, the flood of it was so bad that they had to cancel it, and they got to go back to the drawing board on how you're going to run this, how that's going to operate. Okay, so Elon, you bought $1.5 billion of this wasteful asset. Well, why don't you just dump it back on the market? I don't want that. I don't want that on my hands. Nah, man. So that's something else. So then Michael Saylor, which it's no way that Elon Musk, being who he is, and as it was defined, that there's no way they did not do the due diligence before getting involved with crypto. Here's a man who wrote software, wrote video games at 12 years old, learned how to do coding at 10 years old, developed a video game strong enough to sell to a company at 12 years old. And you're going to tell me he don't know how the Bitcoin, algorithm works? The one who at the start of the internet craze, going to Stanford after so many other graduating a couple other places, Canada and what have you, going to Stanford, but then when the internet craze was just getting started, dropped out of Stanford 2 days after to get into the internet piece. So you're there with that, and you're there with PayPal. And then you don't know the strength of what Bitcoin actually is, and your business is energy. Your business is energy. You're talking about space. You're talking about electric cars, and how much studying do you have to do in order to understand the relationship between, you know, battery-powered cars and fossil fuel cars? No, come on now. You got an IQ of 155, et cetera. So it's like, oh, I didn't know that. You know, I just found out. They got a big carbon footprint. No, man, you lying. And Michael Saylor knows that too. And those people who are in the business world, they know the game. The game, recognized game. They already know. So let's get to this. Let's get to these energy points that Michael Saylor brought up. So let's start with this. It says that in the world generates 150,000. Kilowatt, 150,000 kilowatt hours a year, right? If I wrote my numbers right, it's quite possible I might have missed that number. 150,000, I'm pretty sure. Yes, 160,000. He said it's one third is wasted, so it had to be 150,000. Of those 150,000 terawatts, that's what he said, 150,000 terawatts. So it's like, whatever, that's big. It's bigger than kilowatts, right? Like we have gigabytes and we have terabytes. So now in this case, annually in the whole world, it is generated 150,000 terawatts. And of that 150,000 terawatts of energy globally generated, 50,000 terawatts of energy, 50,000, one-third of those terawatts of energy are wasted anyway. It's wasted anyway, right? Just think about all the plastic bottles that are used and how many of those plastic bottles become waste, right? Okay, same way with energy. Look, this, the cars that we drive. This is all a part of the conversation, right? You drive your car. You might not see the exhaust that's coming out. We pray you don't, but there's exhaust coming out of all these cars and all these machines and all these things that everything that's using energy, there is a byproduct of that use of energy. And so everything is not energy efficient. You know, the refrigerators are not energy efficient, et cetera. And there are industries and there are manufacturers whose interest is to make all these appliances more energy efficient, right? Okay, well, in the meantime, of they're not being energy efficient, what's happening with the energy that's not being efficiently used? Well, it's wasted energy. So there's a waste of 50,000 terawatts of energy every year globally. That's one-third. All right. Then, so Michael Saylor says, first, that's the case right there. It says why the energy usage of BTC isn't a threat. He's explaining, it's like people want to talk about us using too much energy. You know, it needs to be using renewable resource, whatever. Why is it not a threat? Because the amount of energy used for the total of Bitcoin in the world, the network, the total network, what is the network? Bitcoin is a global network of computers decentralized around the globe. Yes, they use energy. That's what computers do. They use energy. Your computer, you can feel the heat of your computer, and it has that, you can feel it getting warm. You know, some of them used to have fans in them and the like. All right. So, yes, to run computers, yeah, they get hot and they have to be cooled down, et cetera. All right. So just Bitcoin alone, the total cryptocurrency ecosystem, let's call it, that's all of them, the thousands of altcoins and Bitcoin, et cetera. I got to find that other name for altcoin. Altcoin is not a nice name for those assets. But I'll look it up and find it again. So it's 2 trillion. All of them are 2 trillion, right? That is so, but Bitcoin has a certain portion of that market, but it has broached, and of course with this recent quote unquote dip, it's below 1 trillion now, but it capped or passed the 1 trillion market cap last month sometime. It don't take long, like 3 weeks ago or so. So that's 1 trillion. Okay, so all of those computers in the Bitcoin network, that's what's being talked about. All those computers around the world and on all the different continents that are, quote, unquote, crunching numbers, running the algorithm, doing the proof of work, blah, blah, Bitcoin mining, et cetera, all of them, I want you to get the numbers straight, that make up the $1 trillion market, let's put it there, that is Bitcoin. It costs about $20 billion to secure that network, meaning that it's able to do what it does because of all the decentralized investment that's been made into securing the network to do the work that the network does that gives us as an asset, right? It costs to do that. Just if you can imagine that Bitcoin was a private corporation. If Bitcoin was a private corporation, then but it had the attributes of this decentralized, at least in terms of magnitude of nodes, which are the various locations around the world where Bitcoin is being mined and where Bitcoin is being traded. Blah blah blah. All that is the Bitcoin network. But imagine it to be Bitcoin Inc., right? And so in order for Bitcoin Inc. headquarters to keep its global network running, it has to spend money to take care of all of the expenses related to the people and the equipment that makes it happen. Michael Saylor points out that the cost is about $20 billion. $20 billion. To do what? To protect an asset that is currently valued at $1 trillion. Okay, looking at the cost. Okay, we're trying to protect and operate a $1 trillion system of value. How much does it cost? It costs $20 billion to do that. And you can see that relative to that, that's relatively inexpensive when you look at it. But since the argument is about the energy costs, it's like, it's too much energy, whatever, fossil fuels, coal, blah, 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 whatever it is. So the idea is that, so he gives the calculation, Michael Saylor gives the calculation, about 0.02 kilowatt hours per Bitcoin up per, that's how much is used, actually, 0.02. In fact, his language is this. He says, It's 0.25% of the wasted energy to run the global Bitcoin network that I just told you, just mentioned to you. So if this corporation, if the Bitcoin was a corporation, if the Bitcoin network was a corporation, the amount of energy that this corporation uses in order to run the network is equivalent to 0.25% of the wasted energy. Right? Meaning it's like going to the garbage can that the wasted energy sits in. Nobody's doing nothing with it. Nobody's using it, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, well, we can use that. Let's use that energy to run our system. So in terms of what's being consumed and what's being used is when you look at it from the perspective of how much energy is being wasted, and as Michael Saylor said, okay, let's take Bitcoin out of the question. Take it out of the question. Remove it from the total global equation in terms of energy consumption, sustainability, and all your arguments, right? Let's take Bitcoin out of it. Okay, now what's happening? There's no more waste. There's no more waste. There's no more problem with energy. Bitcoin is the problem for energy consumption around the world. It's like, no, you're still going to be wasting 50,000 terawatts of energy every year. Now here comes Bitcoin that brings an asset and a value into the world at the cost of only 0.25% of the energy that you're wasting. It's going to be wasted anyway, Bitcoin or no Bitcoin. But you're going to argue that wasteful? So that's what it said. And he pointed out that, look, if you're really concerned about the environment, you have targets that are so much bigger than Bitcoin, which is using 0.25% of wasted energy to run a $1 trillion global network. It's like you need to look at these dirty sources. Let's say this, just FYI, so we can know what they are or have some idea. So there are renewable energy, which Bitcoin uses a great deal of that, and there are non-renewable energy sources, right? The renewable energy sources are solar, hydroelectric, geothermal, wind. And there's also biomass. You know, I guess it's sort of like, you know, people make fuel out of, I don't know, corn or something like that. So biomass is what it's called. All right. So those are renewable, quote unquote, clean energy sources. Non-renewable and sometimes called dirty energy sources, right? Oil, coal, nuclear, and natural gas, all right? So I don't have the charts in front of me about how much of what levels of energy is used by what industries, but the point that there are much bigger targets to say, well, y'all need to stop this and y'all need to stop that because you're using too much fossil fuels, you're using too much crude oil or whatever else. Is like you need to go after them. Along with which, when you talk about who's in their effort, what they're bringing to the table, right? It takes more energy to produce an ounce of gold than it does to produce an equivalent amount of Bitcoin. And then when you look at the value, what Bitcoin brings to the table, what gold brings to the table, it's also outstripped there, right? So it's like there's more waste in that you have been given traditional value and deference too. So what's the charge on the gold production? What's the charge on the production of other things? And when you look at what it takes for banks, you got a 10 minute transaction with cryptocurrency. That is, I buy and sell crypto in 10 minutes. In this transaction, I've moved tens of thousands, even millions of dollars in that 10 minutes.
And then you look at the traditional legacy banking system, fractional reserve banking system, with all these intermediaries in the chain of transaction, in the chain of transaction. It's like, okay, how much energy is being burned in that? I put a check in the ATM or what have you, and I do whatever is done in the traditional banking side. How much energy was spent in that, in the building that you were in, the telephone that you were using, the computer that you were using, all that just for that transaction? And what about the larger transactions that take days and weeks involved with that? How much energy goes into that? Whereas a 10-minute transaction on cryptocurrency burns far less energy. But see, the point is that's what we say, it's a red herring. It's a non-argument. It's like the argument, Barack Obama, don't vote for him, he's a Muslim. Barack Obama, don't vote for him, he's a socialist. What? Yeah, where's the birth certificate? It's like anything we can do to stop the rise, to stop the growth, to stop the movement. So they're running out of lies. Go back somewhere. There's an article somewhere. I know it is because it's always coming up. I know there's one site where there's so many times Bitcoin has been declared dead. It's been declared dead. And so they have this tombstone, and the tombstone shows that this is what it was when it first started talking about it, 2013, 2014, 2015, all the way up there. It's dead. So now, same conversation. But now you have to come with something else now in terms of what are you using to try to impugn or discredit crypto. Oh, it's the carbon footprint. It's the fossil fuel. It's the energy consumption. Where before it's drugs, child pornography, the Silk Road, money laundering, et cetera. The biggest money laundering asset, if you want to call it that, the biggest money laundering asset is the American dollar. Okay. All right. So going to take a little step further. These are things that further undermine that argument, right? So Michael Saylor was pointing out that, okay, you want to indict the miners. So the problem is cryptocurrency mining is what's doing costing all this. So just to touch on a couple of those 7 points that he mentioned in his presentation. First thing I want to mention is the price versus the value, part of which I just mentioned. When you talk about the cost of production and then the return that comes from what it is that you're producing, right? Okay, it costs so much to produce a Bitcoin, let's say, or it costs so much and also it costs so much to maintain the global network that is cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. All right, okay, what's the return? What's the return in terms of what is actually gained there? Now, there are concrete and there are institutional values, the abstract institutional values beyond the idea of the quote-unquote actual Bitcoin reward that comes from the mining aspect of it. It's like it's really – you can't really put a price tag on the value. So the price is what it costs to produce it, and the value is what you get from it. The value that comes from Bitcoin in its existence, that's the problem for the existing system and those who have a vested interest in the legacy financial system of the world. It's like if that changes, that's a problem. The idea of stop it before it spreads is a part of that. There's a community of interest, a global community of interest that want to suppress, depress, eliminate cryptocurrency in general, Bitcoin especially, because all those things that those people who have made their bones and made their wealth, if you will, through the legacy system, the language in crypto is becoming disintermediated. Disintermediated. And so I mean, eliminating the middleman. The middleman is the name of the game in this legacy transactional fiat system. Is like middleman. You want to be the middleman. You really don't have to do anything but stand between one, then they give you that, so you take your piece of that, then you give it to the other, and then they give you get a piece off that. All you did was just stood there to take from one, give to the other, take from the other, give to the one, and you get paid going either way. You get paid when it passes you by from the west, and you get paid when it passes you by from the east. What did you do? You didn't just stand there and handed it to the other person, you know? So that's, but then that's in every part of the nervous system in the whole stream of logistics for business in the world right now. Intermediaries and what smart contracts and other things like that do is eliminate the middleman and guarantee even more trust in the transaction itself. And so it's like, that's a threat. It's, you're threatening my job. You're eliminating me. Just like those people that worked on the assembly lines in the auto industry, and then here comes robotics. Oh, that's a problem. Well, it's the same way for the financial industry, and here comes cryptocurrency. It's like, that's it. So that's why, who's going to speak up for us? Who's going to stop this juggernaut of Bitcoin? And here comes Elon Musk, if you will, in this, who seems to be the Goliath, the hope of the month. For, okay, well, maybe Elon can stop it. Okay, well, look. So here's some of the reasons that Michael Saylor says. He says one of the things reason it doesn't work, and that's, it's a non-argument against it, because there is so much value coming through it that is, quote, unrecognized, and that the people, you have to deny this in order to stay with that argument. And that's why I file all of these under, if it don't make money, then it don't make sense. If it don't make money, then it don't make sense. Point is that these things would not be happening if they were not profitable, what I'm listing right now, and I draw this list from what Michael Saylor was saying. I say he's listing all the positives, or not listing all of them, but the major positives that are the natural features of the Bitcoin operation, cryptocurrency at large. Anyway, this is what, one of them is this: miners are buying energy. You talk about they're burning energy, they're too much fossil fuels, too much this, too much, you know. In the jurisdictions where they are, they're not, it's not like a next door neighbor plugging his stuff into your house power and then drawing from your power, and you paying the bill. No. The miners, wherever they are, there's an energy bill for what they are expending. And the difference is that they buy it, as Michael Saylor was saying, they buy it at like 45 to 50 cents per kilowatt hour. That's what's being paid out to the jurisdiction that is allowing those miners to do what they do, where they do what they do. So they are buying energy, whereas, and the point being again, that it's basically 0.02 per kilowatt hour to produce the Bitcoin, and you're in a jurisdiction where you need that energy, need that power, but it's being sold to you by that jurisdiction for like 0.45 to 0.50 cents per kilowatt hour to run your operation. So who's getting that that excess, that arbitrage, whatever you want to call it? That the jurisdiction said, come on in, set up your mines right here. Is that okay? Pay me. So it's like, who is it that's complaining? Oh, that's chewing up all the energy. I can't even turn my TV on because they can't. Okay, no, it's more beneficial in the jurisdiction where they're operating until it isn't, right? And that's what was pointed out as well. So it's a natural scenario. If in fact it's more expensive, it's more deleterious to a particular environment, locality, jurisdiction, etc., to have mining operations in their city, then the mayor, the town hall, and everybody say, bye, no, you can't do it, it's not worth it, boom, boom, boom. And that's not the case, such that wherever that might have been the case, if it turns out to be such a case, maybe no doubt there is. But that's not the big statement. The point is they will be booted out, and they will have to take their operations somewhere else where it makes dollars and cents for them to do that. So what's going to happen in the adaptive function and the natural selection order of things, everybody's going to wind up in the place where it makes sense to do it here, and everybody's happy, right? So that's going to be the natural outworking of it, right? So not only that, not only they're buying energy, but the mining operations themselves are buying technology. So there's profit in the persons who are setting up mining operations, because the chips, the computer chips, and the whatever hardware, et cetera, that's needed in order to have a mining operation, that's money. And the more demand, then the price follows along with the demand. And so, therefore, the people who are in the business of making the chips and making the hardware, it's profitable. So they make it profitable. They're not giving it up for free. They make it profitable for them to sell it to those people who are setting up those operations. And those who are setting up those operations, they're setting up in a way where they're buying what will enable them to be more profitable as Bitcoin miners. And that's what's going on. So it is a win-win situation for those people too. So they're buying technology. So the miners, so again, the idea is it's not just the miners are taking away something. It's like if you are living off the public commonwealth, you know, not paying your fair share. No, it's creating business and sustaining businesses that are in that particular field. So they're buying technology, computer chips, and tech, and the tech is improving. And the whole energy use is also being improved at the same time. You think these miners, they want to keep paying the high electrical costs, et cetera. So by using a technology that's not energy efficient, and so there's somebody somewhere working more and more to make the chips more energy efficient, the hardware more energy efficient, et cetera, et cetera. And so what's that? That's leading to an evolution of improvement. That's happening. There's a big, big, important punchline in the longevity or the scheduled reduction of Bitcoin available. And inshallah, we keep going through and get to that point, because that is a major punchline. So again, the miners are buying technology, computer chips, hardware. The technology is being improved in order for them to become even more energy efficient, and that has been upgrading on and on and on. The third thing that miners, and we're speaking specifically of Bitcoin miners, they are also beneficial for Wall Street. They're beneficial for Wall Street because in order to have an operation that makes dollars and cents for as far as a crypto mining operation, then you know, it has to be financed. You got to get the money from somewhere, and those people who are looking at the prospects, coin mining and the industry, and those who are those banks and other Wall Street institutions, hedge funds, whoever they are, investing in those operations, then that's a profit center for them as well. By doing what? Investing in crypto mining. And then you got all the other things. You got the Grayscales of the world and other hedge funds and other things like that. That, hey, this is a business opportunity. BlockFi, so many others that are moving out and into other aspects of the whole financial infrastructure that is going to be serving a world. It and is already serving a world, but a growing world. With all the financial services, all of the means of financial transactions that you see in the traditional legacy system right now, all that is being transitioned and created and moving into the crypto space. All right, and we already said the idea is that mining it goes wherever it's welcome until they're not. You know, and that's it. So he talks about the governor of Texas. It's like, listen, these governors and these people, they're not going to let you set up if it's not beneficial to the people or if it's harmful to their own political future. They're not going to have it. So the point is, nobody is just, you know, Bogarting that we setting up. No, it's not going to happen. And so that's how it is. Now here's a major point. The way that the Bitcoin is, you have what you call the halving, H-A-L-V-I-N-G. And so from the time of the inception of Bitcoin, right? So we got round figures 2008 when it was released. Every 4 years, there's a halving, meaning that the reward for mining Bitcoin gets cut in half, right? And there is basically a block created every 10 minutes, and the algorithm is set up in such a way that is like clockwork. So there's little move, little wiggle room, but round figures, like every 10 minutes, a block is completed, and that's built into the algorithm. What's also built into the algorithm is that every four years, the block reward is cut in half. So I'm not going to go through all those numbers in terms of that. But I think I think it's not part of my notes right now, but you can look it up easily. I think the reward now is like six and a quarter Bitcoin per block, something like when you. If you solve a block, then you get 6 1/4 Bitcoin. Where before that it was 13. Before that, whatever the math says. So now 2020, right? So you have from 8/08, then you got 12, and then 16, then 20. So then in 2024, it's going to be cut in half again. And the end of all the blocks having been mined. 2040, the year 2040, there will be no more Bitcoin to be mined. That's a mathematical, quote, certainty, right? All right. So where are we right now? 2021, right? So 10 years, right? 19 years before it, on calculated basis, all Bitcoin be mined. So then what happens to Bitcoin mining? Bitcoin mining is over. Bitcoin mining is over. This complaint about this irrelevant complaint by comparison of whatever, sustainability, da, 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 da. Okay, well, that argument is gone. 19 years for sure. That's without even considering the value that's been brought on board between now and the 19 years, right? So it's like this is the mining period, and that's not even considering the evolving efficiency and the transition from these other, quote-unquote, you can call them dirty sources, dirty energy, as the natural evolution is going to bring in more clean energy type activity and reduce all that. That's all that's in the cards. These people who own and hold billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, they have an interest in solving these kind of problems, these kind of critiques, et cetera. So that's happening. There are people who are investing in all of the above right now. But the point is that by the time you get to 2040, which is only 19 years now, I got grandbabies, mashallah, 3 years old right now, so they'll be 22. They'll be 22, and no more Bitcoin being mined. So I'm saying that's tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like tomorrow. So it's like this complaint, this argument right here, it's like it's irrelevant. Now, to speak to how that should impact you, this is one of the let's finish this point. So this, as he says, 20 years out, meaning henceforth, 20 years out, all Bitcoin will have been mined. Then the network, that global network that is the Bitcoin network and also globally cryptocurrency in general, the network is only going to be focused on transactions and not mining. All the mining will be over. So the energy reduction, I mean, it's like, I don't know, does anybody know how much it costs to run the internet? You know, what does it cost and who's paying the cost? Where's the central receiver for all costs to the internet, right? So it's like, yeah, it's going to be likewise for the global financial network of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, as we're including Bitcoin. So it's like, so this argument about, oh, look how much it's costed. The cost is going down as we speak. The marginal cost is some of the language for marginal cost. As technology improves, the price of anything approaches zero. It's everything. Things that used to, how much did it cost to publish a book 20 years ago? How much did it cost? You want to publish a book and get it out in the market. How much did that cost? Okay. How much does it cost now? How much does it cost now in the context of getting it produced and getting it out to the world? So the cost then and the cost now. How is that possible? How did that reduction go down? It went down because the technology improved and greater access to the technology came to the people who wanted to publish. Okay. And here's another thing, the idea that cryptocurrency, you're in a position with cryptocurrency to make your own money, not just like, man, I need to make some money. No, you can make your own money. That's the issue of the Doge, the whole Dogecoin thing is like, is a meme. And that's the other side of the Iblisi Joker Trump side of Elon Musk. We don't have time to go into it. We'll get into it, inshallah, another point in time. But this is game. This is him laughing at the society that he feels himself to be so superior to. And quote unquote, it's an inappropriate comparison, but yes, you are an outlier. You are, you know, a giant in so many ways. You have done things that so many people have deemed to be impossible before. Yes, you've done that. That's fine. But at the same time, that is for that good. Point is that those achievements have effectively, well, they are part of the reason, have effectively made you totally disrespectful of the common person, and even and especially just like Trump and his followers, the Elon and his followers, it's like, you know, it's like minions, right? Minions that. It's like I have no respect for the common person. I have no respect for the system. It's like I have no. You can control and manipulate things at will. That's his attitude, and a part of what was done to the Bitcoin price recently is, in perhaps in his view, a testimony to that fact. But that's not the end of it. Let me say this, and if you have any comments or questions that you'd like to bring up before I close it, because I am going to close out shortly, just push one on your phone, and when I get back to the studio, inshallah, I'll open it up to you. Let me see here. Yeah. Okay. One thing that I want to mention is that Who is it that stands to gain with this situation? It's like the we call them whales, right? The whales, they are big boys, but Elon is a bigger boy. his estimated worth is like $164 billion, and not too long ago. When I say not too long ago, I mean within the last 6 weeks, I'll put it this way, within the last 6 weeks, even when crypto was at its, or Bitcoin per se, was at its, at or near its all-time highs, you know, in the 60s, in the 60,000s, actually would take about $98 million movement of a value of $98 million to move the market 1%. Just $98 million to move the market 1%. Okay? So anybody who wanted to move the market, you've heard me talk about the pump and dump scheme, the way the big boys play the game. Like, it's just so easy, you know, to get those people. You get the retail buyer, the common Joe, who's out there in the street, the Robin Hood, the Cash App folks, the whoever, who's jumping in, I got to buy Bitcoin, whatever, without really knowing what you're involved with. So you go get it. That's the big boys is in the side wings or what have you. You know, buying over the counter and the like, so as not to scare the market, but then getting people to come into the market. Yeah, they got it. And then what they do is, boom, they scare those retail buyers who have bought up the coin. They scare them to dump it on the market. Oh, I better get out. Oh, it's going down. Oh, man, I shouldn't have done it. So you've dumped it up, and they're there to scoop it up. It's like one of those nature films, right? It's like one of those Discovery Channel type thing, how the whale feeds himself. I mean, literally. You gotta look that up. Wallahi, it says, the whales go around whatever kind of fish it is that they like to eat, right? And they will create this kind of vortex around fish, you know, how these fish go in flocks, right? Flocks or whatever you call it, schools. The schools, right? And so these whales, this is the way they get fed, right? So what they literally, like, you take a rice ball or something and you bunch it up so you can just put the whole thing in your mouth. That's how the whales do. They get this tremendous pool of fish and the whales go around. So they wind up in this ball. And then that whale comes up under that ball of fish that has been spun out in that vortex with his mouth is open. And eats all those little fish. And that's what happens with people who run up there. Let me get $10 out of the big. Alhamdulillah, get $10 out of the Bitcoin. Alhamdulillah. Allahu Akbar. Get more than that. You'll never be able to get more. I don't want to make light of it at all. But I am saying that if you go in and you are what you call FOMO'd in, fear of missing out, but you're not doing it based on any study, any due diligence, any futuristic view, any knowledge of what it is that you're getting into. You just run it. All you are is bait. If you don't take it seriously and you don't do it as an investment, which will not bother you when the price goes up or down, you're not doing it the right way. Okay, it's like Las Vegas is glad to have you come on in and give you, you know, whatever they call it, get comped rooms and comped dinners and da da da. It's like because we're gonna give you that because you're gonna leave here. This is why it's called lost wages, right? It's like you're gonna leave here without what you came with, and you're gonna keep thinking you're gonna win, and you're gonna keep playing, and I'm gonna let you win some. Then I'm gonna come back and get the rest of it, right? Well, mashallah, I'm just saying for those who are operating without knowledge. And running up in there because, yo, yeah, I'm going to get some, man. I see that going up, man. I'm going to get some. It's like all you are is a fish that the whale is going to go around and he's going to eat you alive. And one of the ways that he eats you alive is by scaring you out of holding on to what you have, right? And so that's what gets done. So Elon Musk doing his thing, there's certain voices. You have the Michael Saylor voices out there. I don't know how many other voices, Anthony Pompliano and some others. And, of course, I haven't heard everybody. But the point is that there are voices that should be coming from other places to shut that down, and they know that it's true. But, of course, their situation is, okay, well, let's let Elon do the dirty work. Let him do the dirty work. Let him push all the FUD and blah, blah, blah. And we'll just be at the gates when people start selling it and the price starts going down, and we'll just be there to buy the dip. That's all right. We didn't sell it. You want to sell it? Okay, well, if he really want to sell it, okay, I'll buy it. Right? And then when that gets shut down, because there's a short shelf life to this because we're dealing with math and technology. When the Elon Musk effect is gone, and the algorithm, which is not affected at all, the algorithm has not, Bitcoin is still being mined at the same rate, the same pace, et cetera. The computer is operating on the algorithm. The algorithm is not affected at all. The only aspect of the market that's being affected is what is the market. The market is the fear and greed among the. And if I can get you to be afraid when I want you to be afraid, and if I can get you to be greedy when I want you to be greedy, that's what I'm manipulating the market. That does not change the algorithm and its calculated, predictable pattern future. It's coming. So when that goes, when all this momentary FUD goes away, then yes, the Bitcoin price is going to be coming back with a vengeance. There was a piece that started to play. I still might play it later, not today. I'll get my sound quality better. Mystical got this song. You ain't seen bouncing back. I wanted to play that. You keep bumping me against the wall. I know I let you slide before, but will G see me? You ain't seen bouncing back. Bitcoin gonna bounce back as crazy. So I say also, last words, mashallah, inshallah. I believe for the believer, because it happened just at the end of Ramadan, and you know I believe that that Bitcoin is a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for those who otherwise couldn't get and benefit in the legacy system, indeed were slaves to the legacy system, and Allah has, rather than it going out further to the 65, to the 75, to the 80, where it just totally like, man, how in the world can I ever touch that in a big manner? But don't ever stop, don't give up or get it. But I think that with Allah bringing that price back down, I mean, we've seen prices under 43,000. So now this price is probably not going to hit there again for a very long time. So I'm saying I believe Allah has brought it back into your atmosphere for you to get it at least cheaper than where it's going, and then you can ride it. You can ride it back up when it goes up, but it's really an opportunity for buying that itself is going to be over in a while. But this is just a news cycle. This Elon Musk thing, this is just a news cycle to shake out the weak hands. Those people who are scared and run out and throw their Bitcoin on the market, trust me, there's no want of people who will not buy that. And that means that it's not going to go down forever. It's just not possible because there's always somebody there to buy it. It's like it doesn't matter. Michael Saylor showed him. Says like y'all go with the news that Elon said this and said that. Let me show you this. Then he tweets out, "We bought 91,000 more Bitcoin. It's a great price." So that's what the big boys are doing. So that's what we say you need to do. All right. Anybody got a comment or question before we go? Push one on your phone. Come on through. If not, we gonna check out. Going once. All right. Got my Monterey Bay eyes down here. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Walaikum assalam, Imam.
Yes.
Walaikum assalam. Okay, so there was a couple of things. One you've already kind of answered for me, and of course my husband answers a lot too, but while I have the opportunity. One thing I was worried about was, not really worried about, but I was thinking about, you know, how would we compete with, I guess what you call the whales, you know, the people that are just mm-hmm. come in and just buy so much. How could we, as a, you know, at our level, compete with them once they started coming in and could, like, you know, buy it all up? But
yeah.
But I see where it's not, from what you were standing there, buying it all up. So, but what I'm trying mm-hmm. to understand, the basic concept of I guess the right way to look at it, and of course, my husband is like thinking this is like, oh, this is the time to like really, you know, get in and everything.
It
so,
is.
But my question is like basically the right way is to look at it that you're not really buying it for yourself to get rich right now. We're really buying it for our 3-year old, like you were saying. I have grandkids that are 3 years old, so we're looking at a legacy thing. We're looking at their tomorrow. We're looking at, you know, we got this far from slavery, and we want them to be that much farther down the road when they get. So we're not looking to try to like, you know, get rich and, you know, buy it and sell it and all that kind of stuff. We're looking at for our grandkids tomorrow for the life that we want
it's
them
both.
To have.
It's definitely both, right? But in the main, since it is an asset, we're talking about Bitcoin, and Fahmi, I see Ismail, so please don't go nowhere.
How can it be both, Imam?
Yeah, it's like this. It's like, I think one analogy was given, like, imagine you own 4 blocks of Broadway in New York. You own that,
mm-hmm.
and it was bought, your parents bought 100 years ago, what have you. So what is that? That's collateral, right? That's collateral. That's value. And so you can hold on to that asset, and there are ways for you to leverage and utilize and collateralize other things without giving up or giving away or selling that asset. That's what's possible also for Bitcoin. So you can keep the asset just like a home, right? You can keep the asset.
Right.
And still have the value, and then use it in collateralizing something in the fiat system to do something that you may need to do or want to do right there, like enter into another kind of business, because you have the strength of that collateral as the foundation for the quote-unquote the loan, if you will, the leveraging that. And you still haven't given it up. You still haven't lost it. And plus you're investing it in something else that you want to do in the world. So it's not just sitting there, quote-unquote, unused per se. It's being used as collateral, but it's still an asset that you own, and it'll stay with you.
Okay.
And keep it in the family.
Right. So just quickly, I know you have other people. So just quickly, for example, my dad buys a house. He dies. He leaves me his house with no free and clear. So now I have his collateral that he left me. He's gone on, but I still have that real estate that he's left me. So if I want to go out and use that real estate to collateral to get money or whatever, I can use it now, but I still have it as collateral to pass on.
Absolutely.
That's what
Bitcoin can do. And its value grows faster than any other, quote-unquote, hard asset in the world right now.
Okay. Alhamdulillah. Thank you, Imam. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Alaikum assalam. All right, Ismail. Thank you for your patience, my brother. What's going on?
Not much. Hey, Mubarak. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mubarak.
I just wanted to point out for the people that may be new listening to this, you made a comment about Bitcoin is always going to be buyers for it. That's why it's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times people may buy these coins at 0.5 cent or 0.25 cent, $5,000 worth, then it jumps up to 33 cents.
Yeah.
And then you want to sell it and you think you're rich, but you don't have any buyers for it. So that's another important point about this. These type of coins that people need to understand. I just wanted to add that.
No, that is very important, and that's the issue of liquidity. That gets back to the Elon Musk aspect of it as well. Because and this is also part of the security of the Bitcoin network, because it is so liquid, right? It's an ocean, right? And so, and that's why it does take, even though Elon, for example, he caused a little bump and a burp in the system at large, but it's only vis-a-vis, quote unquote, the weekends, et cetera. But the point is that Bitcoin is just too big to be moved. It's like trying to dry up the ocean. You know, it's like nobody's big enough to dry up this ocean, but you can you can move it. You can start a little. You can start some waves, etc. But sooner or later, the wave's gonna go down, which is gonna be the case here. But yeah, that's very important. So yeah, getting into those altcoins that don't have the kind of liquidity and don't have the kind of market, the daily market activity that justifies you if you're gonna be speculating. Then that's a part of the due diligence. You got to make sure that, you know, is there a buyer on the other side of what you're getting involved with, or are you going to be in a situation where you FOMO'd into something and then the dudes who started it, we call it rug pull, right? I know you know about this. I'm just giving the language. The rug pull is just to bring suckers in, just like in the old gold rush days. So you got to be intelligent about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. Alaikum assalam. All right, brothers and sisters, that's going to be it for today. Anytime you got questions, hit us with those questions. You can hit me on the email, et cetera. And just before I start in, the builders of the website, they set for a conversation with me to start working out some of the last details. Inshallah, it is coming. Make dua for us and us. Make dua for our co-hosts. Brother Malik, inshallah, may Allah protect him and grant him full, inshallah. Everybody have a wonderful day, evening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.